Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
There is a place that is spoken about only in whispers. A dark area that spawns the beginnings of urban legends. A place where anything can happen and usually does. During the light of day, it hides just outside of view. But when the sun goes down, spirits, creatures of the night, roam free, and things do go bump in the night. It is in every state and every country, and there is no escaping it, no matter how safe you feel behind your locked doors and latched windows. So we invite you to turn down the lights and turn up your radio while we join Dave Schrader and Tim Dennis, your hosts, on a journey into the darkness on the edge of town.
Hello and welcome. This is Wednesday and you're tuned in to the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness, part of the Jericho Network here on Podcast One. You can find us Monday through Friday as we continue to bring you through the strange realms of the world around us, looking everything from ghosts to UFOs, abductions, monsters, myths, legends, and we get into some really interesting mysteries in different parts of history, Tim. And I know one of the things you're always interested in is stuff dealing with the ancient structures around the world.
Yeah.
Like Egyptian pyramids and some of the different things that have popped up around the world that look eerily similar in cultures where they should have no way to communicate how to do what they're doing.
Right.
And we hear all of these different theories from massive enlightenment to angelic intervention to aliens. And what is it that's behind these mysteries? Why are you so fascinated with Egypt, Tim?
Well, I tell you, there's kind of a draw to me to Egypt, and there's some of it that's explained, some of it that's not explained. I think early on in our education system, we tend to tackle it very early, at a very early age. And to me, it's kind of a morbid fascination. You know how when you're a kid, when you first hear about death, and it's the death rituals, the death like mummies and things like that, right, are very... It's a very morbid culture, and the symbology of Horus and the different hieroglyphs and everything, and to me it felt very foreign, but at the same time it felt very familiar. So it was one of those things where as we started to study it in school, I thought this is just the coolest thing ever. And then the Science Museum had exhibits, and we went and saw the exhibits at the Science Museum. And then I thought, wow, this is just the coolest thing ever. And then I got into that. And then from there, you start to get into the different cultures of the world and how things are similar in their ancient cultures and how everything lined up with the different pyramids in Egypt. And I thought to myself, it was just bizarre, but it was Egypt that sparked everything.
Mm-hmm.
And the culture itself to me is fascinating. And there's an explainable reason why. I think it's because it is so fascinating in its morbidity. Is that a good way to put it?
Trademark it. I'll take it.
And it's also fascinating in its mystery. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of mystery to it. There's some things that are easily explainable by archaeology, and there's some things that are not explainable. Mm-hmm. I think it's that mystery of how did such an advanced civilization come up? Because there are some things, some tools that can be explained as to how you built these gigantic pyramids. And then there are some things that are unexplained. We can't.
Right, this kind of forbidden knowledge or forgotten wisdom through the centuries.
Right.
I grew up going to a Lutheran grade school.
Mm-hmm.
So we were steeped heavily in the religious text, and we would talk a lot about Egypt and about, the Exodus and all of the strange stories from the Bible. So Egypt always kind of had this weird lock on me just because it sounded like a place of magic and mystery.
Right.
And you've got pharaohs, you've got sorcerers, you've got these giant, magnificent pyramids and structures, mm-hmm. and just this astounding culture that mm-hmm. took place there. So that kind of drew me in, as you said. Then I grew up right in the heat of the King Tut popularity and explosion.
Yes, yeah.
You know, the '70s when they were doing the big tour and Steve Martin was all the rage on the radio with his King Tut song.
Yep.
So that, I think, helped to capture the imagination of not only myself, but many adults and children at that time.
Right.
And wanting to understand what went on and all of the mythos behind the legends. Mm-hmm. And I'm always fascinated about this. And when you can start to look at mysteries and unraveling history's stories and getting to the bottom of it, we think a lot of what we know in history is right. And we're given one line of history and one line of stories. And for the most part, people swallow the pill and accept it, right? Mm-hmm. But then you have other people that come in and take a look at things and maybe look at a different perspective of history. And they find sometimes things are much more telling and much different than we were led to believe. Well, our guest, Scott Crichton, is here with us this evening. He's an engineer whose extensive travels have allowed him to explore many of the world's ancient and sacred sites. The host of the Alternative Egyptology Forum on the AboveTopSecret.com website, he is the author of The Secret Chamber of Osiris and co-author of The Giza Prophecy. He lives in Glasgow, Scotland. His book that we're talking about tonight is The Great Pyramid Hoax, The Conspiracy to Conceal the True History of Ancient Egypt. Welcome to the show, Scott. Thank you for joining us this evening.
Hi there, Dave. Hi there, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here all the way from Scotland. Hope you guys are doing okay tonight.
We are. You know, I had a chance to go to Scotland a few years ago and kind of be a part of your culture for a couple of weeks. And what an absolutely beautiful place. I can't wait to get back out to Scotland. That is, I think, one of my favorite locations on planet Earth. Just the beauty, the history, the majesty of your country is really just wonderful.
Yeah, when you head up to the Highlands of Scotland, you find, you know, there's just an atmosphere about the place, a real mystical atmosphere that just permeates through your entire body. It's just an incredible experience, incredible place.
Scott, talk to me a little bit about your background. What got you involved in fascination with all of these historic sacred sites and digging deeper into the history than what we've been told in textbooks?
Okay, well, it's pretty much what you guys were kind of talking about there at the top of the show, Dave. Like yourselves, I was taught from a very young age in primary school or junior school, you know, about the ancient Egyptians, about, you know, the pharaohs, the pyramids with their tombs, and, you know, that just, for me, you know, as a kid of 7 or 8, that just blew my mind that, you know, these ancient people could build such massive tombs or structures. And, you know, for me, you know, as a young kid, you know, you're fascinated by all sorts of things, you know, like dinosaurs and stuff like that. You know, for me, these pyramids were just even a bigger mystery than, you know, the dinosaurs, a bigger thing to look into. You know, dinosaurs and stuff like that, you know, it's like these pyramids were bigger than the dinosaurs, you know.
Right.
So it was just it just captured my imagination, you know. But you realize that, you know, as you get older, you begin to realize that there are some questions, well, lots of questions, in fact, that Egyptologists, you know, mainstream Egyptologists simply cannot answer about these structures. You know, you were talking again at the top of the show of that there are lots of unanswered questions. And I think it requires a different perspective to attempt to answer those unanswered questions. You know, we have questions like, for example, the pharaoh Sneferu, who was the father of Khufu. Khufu built the Great Pyramid. But his father, Sneferu, he built 4 pyramids. And Sneferu's father, Huni, built 6 pyramids.
Wow.
Khufu himself built 4 pyramids. You know, so we are taught in school that, you know, these are the tomb of the pharaoh. So why do these guys need so many tombs for one body? You know, so there's one big question right away. You know, why did they do this? And we're talking about, in the case of, Snefru at least, you know, giant pyramids he built, you know. So why did these pharaohs need all these different pyramids for one body? So that's just one question. Then you find, you know, the other questions like the stone boxes, or Egyptologists call them sarcophagi, these granite or basalt boxes that they find in the main chambers, which the Egyptologists call burial chambers. I call them simply the main chamber because I don't believe for a moment that they were ever conceived as burial chambers. They may have been used later, you know, with subsequent later dynasties as burial chambers, but not in the beginning. That was not their purpose or their function. You know, so the Egyptologists point to the stone boxes in these and claim they're sarcophagi. Well, if they were sarcophagi, here's the question. Why in the second pyramid at Giza in 1818 did Giovanni Belzoni he prized the lid off the granite box in that main chamber, and he found it not with a king's body in it, but it was simply filled with plain old earth. Okay? You know, so why are the ancient Egyptians burying a box of earth in this pyramid? You know, so there's questions like that. Why are these sarcophagi, or so-called sarcophagi, why are they totally anonymous? Why are the pyramids totally anonymous? There's not a single official inscription in any of these pyramids. There are some writing has been found inside the Great Pyramid, up in the upper chambers above the main king's chamber of the Great Pyramid. These small chambers are known as the chambers of construction, or the relieving chambers. They found some painted marks in those chambers, you know, graffiti, essentially workman's graffiti in those chambers. That's the only official writing that's ever been found in any of these early giant pyramids. They're completely anonymous, and that's another big question. So it's all these questions, Dave. It's all these questions. You know, for me, I hate not knowing the answer to something. And the thing was, the more you read of the mainstream books, mainstream opinion, you just were not getting the answers to these particular questions. Yeah, they were having a go at this or that, maybe this and maybe that, but nothing for me that was particularly convincing. You know, so I felt, as I got older, that, you know, I had to find answer to these questions. And that's basically what I did. I went on my own personal quest to study this subject in great depth. And, you know, in my studies, I have come to a completely different perspective than the mainstream opinion. I wouldn't say that my opinions or my ideas are alternative as such, or radically alternative. I'd say they're more sort of radical revisionist. You know, I accept that these pyramids may have been used as a tomb by, as I said earlier, by later dynasties of the ancient Egyptian civilization, but I am absolutely convinced that they were never, could never have been conceived as tombs. So this was a personal quest for me, quite simply, to try and find answers to the questions that Egyptology simply hasn't answered, or hasn't answered convincingly.
All right, well, let's start there then. You don't believe that they were set up to be tombs to begin with. So in your perspective, what do you believe that these huge storage houses were actually created to do?
Okay. What we have to do there, Dave, is we have to go back to the beginning. And, you know, this is a thing that Egyptologists, they just simply gloss over history that doesn't jive with their particular perspective, mm-hmm. with their particular narrative, okay? They just simply ignore it. That doesn't fit, ignore it, okay? So let's go back to the original texts that have come down to us, Okay. Now, there is an Arabic writer, some Arabic text by a chap called Al-Masudi. And he translated some ancient Egyptian texts that were handed down, obviously, to the Arab chroniclers. Now, these ancient Egyptian texts tell us of a time in remote antiquity when something strange occurred in the heavens. The stars moved out of their normal course across the sky. The sun rose slightly different in the morning and set slightly different in the evening. The moon moved out of its normal course across the heavens. So all these strange things were happening in the sky. And the ancient Egyptian king Saurid, he asked his astronomer priests, what does this mean? What does this change in the heavens mean? And astronomer priests had a discussion about this, and they explained to the king, King Saurid, that in 300 years' time, there will be a great flood, a great deluge, which will flood and drown the entire kingdom of Egypt. Now, upon hearing this, King Saurid said, okay, what we're going to do is prepare for this disaster, a preemptive plan to construct massive pyramids, and into these we will place everything that this kingdom, our kingdom, needs to reconstitute itself or to be reborn again after the worst effects of the deluge has passed. So within these pyramids, they placed everything that the civilization would need to basically be reborn again, you know, things like seeds, all manner of seed types, tools, lots of different pots and pottery, you know, their culture and written in stones, medicine, you know, knowledge basically would be placed, astronomical knowledge, knowledge of their physics, their science would be placed within these structures. That is why these structures basically were built. But it, as I said, it's a narrative that is completely ignored by mainstream Egyptology. But when you actually look at the evidence, Dave, when you look at the evidence, let's take, for example, the first pyramid at Saqqara, the Step Pyramid. This is the first pyramid that the ancient Egyptians ever built. And it's a giant pyramid, okay? One of the early giant pyramids. Now, when the early explorers of that pyramid in the early 20th century, I think it was about 1920s, explored underneath that pyramid. Now, underneath the Step Pyramid at Saqqara, there are passageways that are literally filled up just below your knee in grain, all types of seed types. Okay? There are galleries that they found under that pyramid, or the remnants. They found 40,000 pots, pottery, you know, vases, jars, plates, you know, all sorts of pottery. They found tools in in these galleries and passageways underneath the Step Pyramid. And you know what, Dave? They've never found the body of a king in any one of these early giant pyramids. Not one. The only body of a king, a pharaoh, that Egyptology has ever found has been the body of Tutankhamun in the Valley of the Kings. It wasn't in a pyramid. It was in a shaft tomb dug deep into the mountainside in the Valley of the Kings. It wasn't in a pyramid. So he's the only pharaoh they've ever found. So when it goes to evidence in terms of, you know, the narratives that have come down to us, you know, the ancient Egyptians tell us that they built the pyramids essentially as some kind of recovery vault or seed bank, recovery system. And when you look at the actual evidence that's been found, yeah, it supports that idea. There's also secondary evidence from the Great Pyramid that it was once filled with massive amounts of grain. You know, so And then we have, you know, the early Christian chroniclers, you know, who tell us that the original ark of Noah was actually a pyramid. You know, so, you know, in Origen's homilies, you read that.
I thought the ark was something that the children of Israel carried with them and took with them with these different items and holy relics contained inside.
Yeah, you're thinking of the Ark of the Covenant. I'm talking about Noah's Ark.
Oh, Noah's Ark. Okay, I'm sorry. Oh, so they believe that that was maybe a large pyramid that he built, not a floating casino cruise ship. It was more of a giant structure to house all of these animals and his family in order to protect them from this flood.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. Okay.
If you look at Ghiberti's Gates of Paradise in Florence, you see that he paints the Ark of Noah as a pyramid, and you see all the animals coming out of this pyramid. You know, so that there is an ancient or an early Christian tradition also that, you know, as I said, Origen's homilies, it tells us that the original Ark of Noah was shaped as a pyramid, you know. So there's all these references and links to the fact that, you know, the original pyramids weren't built as the, let's call it, the tomb of the king, but rather the womb of the kingdom, okay? That's the way I kind of like to view it. It was a massive recovery project that the ancient Egyptians were building. And there's a lot of other evidence to support this particular argument that I'm putting forward.
Well, if Scott, if they're not finding the bodies of these kings and pharaohs inside of these, what they call giant burial structures, why are they insisting that that's what they're created for? Why are they trying to pigeonhole that or compartmentalize that aspect of the story?
Okay, well, I think it partly boiled the answer to that is partly because later dynasties of ancient Egyptian kings, basically the giant pyramids of ancient Egypt, like at Saqqara and Giza, Abu Rawash, you know, the red pyramid, the bent pyramid, you know, these early giant pyramids, these were the original recovery system, you know, for the recovery of the kingdom, not the rebirth of the king, but the rebirth of the kingdom. These were so successful that in time, these would become religious icons. They would be sanctified. You know, they would be religious icons. And later Egyptian kings, that their religion would evolve from that idea that these structures were the means to rebirth. Yeah. So what you find then is that later dynasties built smaller mud brick pyramids, not your giant pyramids with cut dressed stone, but much smaller inferior pyramids, usually built of mud brick, because they wanted a bit of that rebirth action. Yeah, the king, he wanted this whole idea, this rebirth for himself. Not formerly it was for the kingdom, but later this idea of rebirth would be an Assyrian rite of the king himself. So that, I think, is why we are kind of conflating two different aspects of the pyramids, and two different purposes of different pyramids are being conflated by the Egyptologists into one thing. The later ones, I believe, probably were used as tombs. This is the smaller mud brick inferior pyramids, because by that time they had become religious edifices, religious monuments, religious structures, which the king wanted to use for himself, because it was known in their religion that these pyramids were the means to rebirth, to be reborn again. But that idea came from a much, much earlier time, but it carried on through the millennia, through the ancient Egyptian civilization. It carried on that idea that these structures, these pyramids, somehow were the means to the afterlife and to a new kingdom. You know, so I believe Egyptologists are basically, you know, they're mixing two different things up, two different ideas. Originally, it was about the rebirth. The original pyramids, the giant pyramids, were about the rebirth of the kingdom. The later pyramids were about the rebirth of the king. Right. And they basically just conflated them and mixed them up.
Well, looking at a conspiracy to conceal the real history, the true history of ancient Egypt, usually in a conspiracy, there's a reason to cover something up because it's shocking. It's something you can't control what the public's thoughts. To look at this history, why would historians and Egyptologists feel the distinct need to hide the real history? It's nothing that would impact our world or civilization or make us feel less secure. So I don't see why the conspiracy would even be at play.
Well, I'm not saying here that it's particularly this particular aspect is a conspiracy per se. Mm-hmm. But what you have to understand is that, you know, the whole edifice of Egyptology is held within the hands of a very few people, a few academics around the world. You know, in terms of, you know, like global population, it's minuscule, the hands in which the ideas are controlled, the knowledge is disseminated. You know, and so a lot of these people have built up their careers and their reputations on maintaining this particular paradigm. They've gone too far down the road now to admit that they're wrong. They've got our past fundamentally wrong, you know, and, you know, they're just basically not prepared to step back from that and to readdress and to relook at the whole question of these early giant pyramids and their true function.
See, that sounds so silly to me. I mean, it's not like, you know, I mean, we look back at medicine and mistakes that have been made along the way with things that have been given to try to aid us. And we rewrite history constantly when it comes to that. You would think in this situation, you would want to be the scientist to break the real facts of a case and a story and share the real history. A, it would give you a mark in society. And B, it would be beneficial for us to have a better, greater understanding for these real mysteries.
Well, yeah, you would think that, but it simply doesn't happen. It's just too locked in. What needs to happen is that basically what we call the old guard, they need to shuffle off their mortal coil, you know, and allow a new, younger breed of, you know, Egyptologists with wider thinking, you know, to take the reins of this subject. Otherwise, it's simply going to be locked in this Victorian paradigm, this Victorian straitjacket. It's basically been taken down a cul-de-sac, which it needs to get through and come back out the other side. And part of that problem has been exacerbated by the likes of the actions of Colonel Vyse in 1837. You know, with the hoax that he perpetrated in these pyramids, that has merely solidified in the minds of the Egyptologists that, oh yeah, well, these definitely are tombs because we found Khufu's name in a hidden chamber in this pyramid. You know, so his actions have helped to solidify that flawed narrative. You know, so it's very difficult for people to extricate themselves because it's almost like a religion, you know, Egyptology to a lot of Egyptologists. You know, it's a very soft science in that respect. It's not hard science in the sense that, you know, 1 + 1 = 2, you know, you can get definitive results. In Egyptology, you simply can't, and there are a lot of questions. So it's a soft science. And, you know, as I said, to a lot of people, you know, I see this online with people debating particular aspects or issues around Egyptology. You know, some of these arguments, and these are just from, you know, lay people, are ferocious, you know, and people simply will not accept that their particular worldview of the pyramids being the tombs of the pharaohs should ever be questioned because – you know, as far as they're concerned, it's fact. And that's it, end of story. You know, so to a lot of people, it's almost like a religion. And I think that's a big aspect of why the changes will only ever happen very slowly.
All right, we need to take a break. When we come back, Scott, we want to discuss with you the majesty of building these huge, complex creations. Why are we led to believe it was done one way and in some ways mysteriously and other ways mystically or magically? Let's get to the real idea behind that when we continue on with the show. All right, we'll be back. We've got more to look at as we look into the Great Pyramid hoax. The conspiracy to conceal the true history of ancient Egypt continues next on Beyond the Darkness.
Beyond the Darkness.
We're back. This is Beyond the Darkness, your home for the best in paranormal talk radio, five nights a week, from ghosts to aliens to monsters, mysteries, and conspiracies, Tim. That's what we love to cover here.
Oh, yes.
Every year, Tim, I love to get out and investigate and see the world. Mm-hmm. And I've had a great opportunity. And hopefully when your legs are all healed up and you're feeling better and healthy and on your feet after eating good food from HelloFresh and getting a good car so you don't have to keep pushing your old beater from TrueCar, you'll be able to join me as we continue to visit different parts of the world. This year, we're going to England.
I'm looking forward to it.
Check this out. This is our sixth year of doing these foreign adventures. Mm-hmm. And this year's 2017 British Invasion, Darkness Radio's British Invasion, we are going to go out there and have an amazing time. Usually takes us 4 to 6 months to sell out these events.
Right.
We sold out our trip in September in 18 hours.
Whoa.
Sold out in 18 hours.
Whoa.
There are so many people interested that we are looking at adding a second trip in August. So
oh, wow.
If you're interested in going to England,
yes.
Neil Story is our host. You've heard him on our show. He's a historian and an author and just fascinating guy. And he knows the goods when it comes to everything from ghosts to vampire lore, to Dracula and Jack the Ripper. You are in for a treat. This has got to be one of the most comprehensive paranormal trips we're ever going to go on. Plus, it includes 2 nights of paranormal investigations, one in a castle and one at the Derby Jail with Richard Felix, our buddy from Most Haunted.
Wow.
Yeah. And you get hotels, you get breakfast and dinners. It's a great opportunity. If you're interested and you want to join me, email me. Dave@darknessradio.com. Dave, that's simple. That's my name.
Oh.
Dave@darknessradio.com. And just say England trip, and I'll put you in our tickler file. And when we're ready to launch that this week, I will email you the link and information, and you can find out more about the trip. Our current one is sold out for September. Our next one will be in August of 2017. We're going back earlier into the year, because that's the only time we're finding accommodations to do this.
Hmm.
The rest of the year is very hard to get in. So if you'd like to join us, email me, Dave@darknessradio.com. You can also check out darknessevents.com to keep up with where you can meet up with Tim and I throughout the year. Michigan Paracon, Chicago Paracon. We're going to be doing the Oddfellows Asylum trip with Bill Chappell, Chris Fleming, and we're going to be out at the Oddfellows Asylum that you've seen on Ghost Hunters and on Ghost Adventures and Ghost Adventures Aftershocks. You can be a part of the mystery and history and investigate it for yourself. Come on out for a rousing weekend of fun, or if you can just come for one day, we have one day and weekend packages available. Check out darknessevents.com. Darknessevents.com. Scott Crichton is our guest this evening. The Great Pyramid Hoax, the conspiracy to conceal the true history of ancient Egypt. All right, Scott, I want to talk about the way that the pyramids were built. What a fascinating aspect of this story. We've heard so many different theories and ideas bandied about. Science has their version of it. Do you see inherent flaws in what they make claims on and how these were built, when they were built, and what functionality was used to create these massive structures?
Well, Dave, we really don't know how they were built, to be honest. Yeah, we can put forward lots of theories, and that's essentially what Egyptologists have done, you know, with their internal ramp, exterior ramp, you know, full front ramp, you know, all sorts of different ramp theories. But nevertheless, that's the conventional theory, is that the ancient Egyptians simply used, you know, a massive, massive ramp. But the problem there, Dave, is that, take, for example, just the Great Pyramid. Now, the Great Pyramid weighs something like, you know, 6.5 million tons, okay? The sides of the Great Pyramid are about 760 feet in length, each side. Which is about 440 ancient Egyptian cubits. Anyway, you know, so that's, it's what, just under 500 feet tall, about 481 feet tall. You know, so it's an absolutely colossal structure. The thing is, the ramp that Egyptologists say that the ancient Egyptians would have required, you know, to construct the Great Pyramid would have been an even bigger project than the Great Pyramid itself in construction. So it begs the question, you know, would they really have done that? And there's no evidence of such a massive ramp being anywhere near the Great Pyramid or even any of the giant pyramids at Giza. So
now this was a people that was proud of what they did and the creations and the structures that they built. In history, and they were intelligent people, and they knew how to show this. Why would they not have passed that knowledge on so that future generations would continue to build these structures and maintain these type of techniques for building? I would think that that would be something that took a long time to learn and would also take a long time to forget.
Yeah. Again, that comes back to what we were discussing at the top of the show, you know, the mysteries, the unanswered questions. You know, the ancient Egyptians, you know, they have documented pretty much most aspects of their lives, their daily lives. You know, we see them cooking, we see them fishing, we see them farming, you know, we even see them copulating, you know. You know, we see every aspect of their life. You know, and yet we don't see anything about how they built these structures. There's nothing. There's zero. It's almost as if these structures were built in a remote epoch that the much later dynasties have completely forgotten, or pretty much forgotten, although there's trace elements of certain legends or myths that came down to them, like their creation myths about the pyramids, the myths of Osiris and Isis, you know, came down, were passed down, they survived. But how these structures were constructed, that's lost, that's forgotten. And the people that built it, that, as far as I'm concerned, were not the ancient Egyptians of the third or fourth dynasties. These structures, in my opinion, and I explain this in my previous book, Dave, The Secret Chamber of Osiris, Lost Knowledge of the 16 Pyramids, I explain how old these structures are and how they were built in that particular book. Now, again, we have to go to, what did the ancient Egyptians say? What has come down to us? What legends or stories are there that relate to the construction of these pyramids, you know, ancient Egyptian stories? Well, one story that we do have that's been passed down to us about the construction of these giant pyramids tells us that the pyramid stones were flown into place. Okay?
Wait, flown?
No, they were flown into place. Now, a lot of people think, well, how is that even remotely possible? Fair enough. You know, people have proposed all sorts of theories, you know, some fairly mundane, some fairly exotic theories to explain this particular myth of the ancient Egyptian flying stones. Now, some people proposed, you know, sonic levitation methods. Well, that's fairly exotic to my sort of more scientific sort of mind. But what I believe it may refer to, and that, again, I always try to look for evidence to support what it is I'm saying, what it is I'm arguing. And in my previous book, The Secret Chamber of Osiris, I argue that these stones may well have been flown into place, but using, you know, science, using the science of thermodynamics. Very simple. Hot air rises, you know. And if you look, have you ever heard, Dave, have you ever heard of a Dakota fire pit?
I have not.
Dakota fire pit.
No, I have not.
Right, okay. This is a very specific type of fire, okay? It's basically what you do is you dig two channels or two pits into the earth, into the ground, parallel to each other. And at the bottom of these, you dig out a small horizontal connecting channel. So it ends up like a U shape. So you basically, you put a fire in, let's say, the left pit, and in the right pit, you basically have an air current. Cold air goes down the left pit and is sucked through the fire, through the small horizontal connecting channel. And that type of fire burns ferociously hotter than most other types of fire. And because it's dug deep down into a shaft, it isn't affected by prevailing weather conditions. And there are loads of these pits, what look like Dakota fire pits, are U-shaped with a small horizontal connecting tunnel at the bottom of them around the Great Pyramid. Okay. Now, what I think these may have been used for, I can't prove it, but I speculate, they may have been used as Dakota fire pits to create enough sufficient heat to fill a large envelope. Now, the very first hot air balloon that the Montgolfier brothers flew in the, I think it was the early mid-18th century, was made of linen and paper. Now, these were two materials, Dave, that the ancient Egyptians actually invented. You know, so they had the materials, you know, paper and linen. All they needed to do was to create a large enough envelope. And I've calculated, which I show in my previous book, that a balloon, a spherical balloon, it doesn't have to be spherical, but a spherical balloon with 100 feet diameter could lift two standard size blocks, pyramid blocks. They weigh about 2.5 tons each. So a balloon of that size could raise about 5 tons plus its own weight and materials. And I believe that these fire pits around the Great Pyramid, or these pits around the Great Pyramid, were probably a similar idea to the Dakota fire pit. And these were used to inflate these balloons, and basically used basically a guy rope attached to the top of the pyramid, anchored at the bottom, and they would just release this balloon, which would be attached to this guy rope with its payload, and it would just fly up to the top level of the pyramid with its cargo, with its payload. Very, very simple, and it would take literally a couple of minutes for that load, you know, to go up to the, you know, the upper levels of the pyramid. You know, so, and if you look at...
And it would lift blocks that heavy.
Yeah, a spherical balloon of 100 feet in diameter.
And
I've
done all the
calculations.
What kind of time would it take to complete a job like that using that technology?
Well, obviously, it's going to be a lot quicker than building a ramp,
right?
You know, a massive ramp, which is much bigger than the pyramid itself. It's obviously much more scalable. You can have as many of these fire pits and balloon lifting devices that you actually need. You know, so, you know, if they've got, you know, 16 of these fire pits around the base of the pyramid, you know, they could be literally lifting, you know, thousands of blocks a day. You know, literally thousands of blocks a day. You know, so, and as I said, if you look at the Temple of Dendera, the Temple of Horus at Dendera, you've probably seen the thing, they call it the Dendera light bulb. Have you seen that ancient Egyptian image? It looks like a light bulb, or that's what Erich von Däniken claims. And basically, I am suggesting that that is actually it's lying horizontally. And basically, what I'm suggesting is that is actually an image of one of these balloons being inflated to carry a stone, because what you see in the room beside this chamber in the Temple of Dendera, there's a, you know, there are other hieroglyphics or these balloon type images, but this time they are rotated 90 degrees, they're vertical, with what looks like it's carrying blocks, stone blocks beneath it. You know, so you have these images which could potentially be a hot air balloon carrying stones. You see it being filled horizontally, and then it's rotated 90 degrees vertically with its payload below it. You know, so to me, that would explain, you know, why or how it's possible, you know, using even primitive technology, you know, it's fairly basic science, you know, using fairly basic science to raise these massive blocks. And I think it's entirely possible, and there's some reasonably good evidence, as I said, around Giza to support that. Now, if your listeners want to see more about that, they can go on to, I've got a YouTube channel, just go on to YouTube, in the search box, just put Scott Crichton flying stones, and they can watch the video of that particular idea.
All right. Boy, this is just fascinating to me. And again, if this kind of technology exists, why is Scott Crichton the one bringing it out? Why are scientists not regaling us with these tales? This would be fascinating. And I would imagine would help in many third world countries in building and constructing functioning buildings and items that they need, that they don't necessarily have the money to create machines to do this kind of work.
Yeah, you know, it's why do Egyptologists, well, I don't know why they I suggest that they've probably never looked or had that perspective. They've never looked at the evidence in the way that I have looked at the evidence, so they've probably never come up with that particular idea. But it would make a great Discovery Channel project to see whether or not it could actually, in fact, work. I suspect it probably could work.
That would be interesting to investigate. But again, looking at this, where is the reason to conceal this information from us? Why?
Well, again, that particular idea is purely a speculation on my part. Egyptologists will insist that they are right and they used ramps, even though there is no evidence or very good evidence for massive ramps. Yeah, there are some small sort of ramps from quarries up to the base of the pyramids, but nothing of the magnitude that would actually be needed to actually construct the Great Pyramid or any of these giant pyramids. You know, so why do Egyptologists hang on to this particular idea? Well, I think, Dave, because it's the only idea that they have, and they've said it for so long that it's almost become dogma, it's become fact in their minds. But there's just very, very little evidence to actually support that. And, you know, as I said earlier, I try to, you know, look for evidence. I try to go with the ancient texts. You know, the pyramids were built, with the stones flying into place. That's the ancient myth that's come down to us. What if that is actually correct? If you work on that premise, then, well, how can we make this work? What evidence, you know, how could we do it? Well, what about, you know, trying this particular idea? Is there evidence to support it? You know, so Egyptologists are just stuck in their ways. That particular thing, you know, it's a conspiracy of silence, in a sense, a conspiracy of not wanting to dig too deep into things, because, you know, I think in a way that they probably don't want to find certain answers. You know, a lot of this as well, I think, is political. You know, the whole argument around the ancient Egyptian monuments, particularly the pyramids, and some of the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. You know, there's a lot of politics around these things as well, that, you know, they don't want to dig too deep in case it challenges some of their preconceptions and political preconceptions, and so they just leave things be, in my opinion. But you know, the biggest conspiracy for me is the fraud of Howard Weiss in 1837, which you'll probably go on to.
Right. Well, let's cover that now. That's an important part of this history. Go ahead. What is the fraud? And for our listeners that are not familiar, please introduce us to Mr. Weiss.
Okay, well, Richard William Howard Weiss was a British colonel. He went to Giza in 1837, basically, you know, it was just a trip of discovery for himself. So in a way, it seems that he ended up there by accident, and eventually ended up, you know, becoming more and more involved in exploring the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids at Giza. Now, Colonel Howard Weiss, in 1837, discovered some hidden chambers inside the Great Pyramid above the main chamber, the King's Chamber. There was one chamber immediately above the King's Chamber called Davison's Chamber, which had already been discovered 70 years before Weiss went to Egypt. But Howard Weiss, Colonel Weiss, discovered other chambers above Davison's Chamber. And when he opened these chambers, he found within those chambers some painted marks. And among these marks was the cartouche. Now, cartouche is essentially, it's a sort of oval shape with some hieroglyphics inside the oval, and that oval shape always symbolizes the name of an ancient Egyptian king. So he found this cartouche of an ancient Egyptian king inside these chambers. Now, these weren't official inscriptions. They were basically crude painted inscriptions using a very basic red ochre paint. It's just basic iron oxide mixed with water. And this cartouche was painted into of Khufu was painted into the topmost chamber, which Howard Weiss called Campbell's Chamber. Now, this cartouche provides Egyptology with their strongest piece of evidence. This, what you have to understand here, Dave, is that they had no hard evidence that the Great Pyramid truly did belong to Khufu prior to this cartouche being found by Colonel Weiss. Now, what the discovery of this cartouche also did, and this is the important part here, is that because Egyptologists at that time had worked out the list of ancient Egyptian kings, the chronology of the king lists of ancient Egypt, they knew that Khufu lived something like 2,500 BC. Now, because Howard Weiss claimed to have found this particular cartouche painted in red, you know, roughly with this basic rudimentary paint inside Campbell's chamber, this then allowed Egyptologists to say the Great Pyramid belongs to Khufu, and it was built 2,500 BC. So that's how important this cartouche is, how crucial it is to mainstream paradigm of attributing the Great Pyramid to the pharaoh Khufu and to that particular era of the Fourth Dynasty. But in my investigations of, you know, Howard Weiss and how he came about these marks, I present a ton of evidence in my new book, The Great Pyramid Hoax, which just basically trashes the whole thing. These marks are a fake. No question about it. This was a fraud perpetrated by Howard Weiss in 1837. I think, for possibly a number of reasons, not for money, because Howard Weiss was a wealthy man in his own right. He was from the British aristocracy, or very closely related to the British aristocracy. He was a very wealthy man in his own right. But it may simply have been for notoriety on his part. We see him writing in his published account that he was desperate to make an important discovery. And specifically, he mentions that he wanted to find Khufu's original burial or his cartouche. These are the two things that he wanted to find. And again, he says quite explicitly in his published account that he wanted to find a cartouche because that would allow him to date the pyramid. Okay? Now, other motivations, well, it could simply be there was a lot of competition at that time. You know, there's a lot of prestige, pride and prestige involved between, you know, Britain, Germany, France, Italy, who all had explorers in Egypt at that time. Britain wasn't finding anything much of great importance, whilst other explorers were. You know, Weiss had spent something in the order of £10,000 of his own money. Now, that translates in today's monetary terms, Dave, to somewhere in the order of about $1.3 million. Oh. You know, so that's a lot of investment to come away with nothing. You know, so when you invest that kind of money, you want to make sure you come away with at least some notoriety. I think the main motivation for Howard Weiss, he was a very religious man. A very pious man, a man of very little humour. He believed in the literal truth of the Bible. He believed in the biblical flood. He believed in the creation. He believed in the creation that took place in, I think it's 4004 BC, which Bishop Usher worked out. And, you know, and this is what was believed in Howard Weiss's time. Obviously, some people still believe that today. So Weiss believed in these things, and the thing that possibly could have worried him more than anything was that the Great Pyramid was older than the creation. So by placing this cartouche within these chambers of the Great Pyramid, Weiss was essentially claiming this structure to be within, you know, the provenance of God's creation. So that may have been another motivation for Colonel Weiss. But as I said, I present a ton of evidence in the book, which basically shows that you know, these marks were fake, and they were faked to ensure, in my mind, that the Great Pyramid could not be older than 4000 BC, and that, to me, is a crime. And incidentally, Howard Weiss, from my research, actually showed that Howard Weiss actually committed fraud much earlier in his life. He actually committed fraud to become a member of the British Parliament, which was serious fraud at the time.
Now, is this speculated, assumed, or is it proven that he has committed fraud?
Oh, no, it's proven. I present the evidence of that in my book. It's proven that he committed this election fraud in 1807. He committed electoral fraud. And we have found diaries which essentially prove that particular point. These diaries, I think, were published after Weiss's death in about 1868, something like that, some years after Howard Weiss had died. These diaries became public knowledge. So when the investigation, when he won this seat in 1807, one of his one of the guys, his challengers, basically a man called Staples, challenged the result of that election, claiming that Weiss had committed electoral fraud. It was investigated by the House of Parliament in Britain, and basically they didn't find any evidence to support Mr. Staples' claim. But the evidence did come out some years after Howard Weiss's death that he did, in fact, commit this electoral fraud. You know, so we're dealing with a character here, Dave, that this guy... you know, he would do pretty much anything to get his own particular way, to get what he wanted, including fraud. You know, so that's the bare bones of this guy. But you know, his actions are basically, as I said earlier in the show, have taken Egyptology down a cul-de-sac. It basically solidified in the heads of mainstream Egyptology that Khufu was indeed the builder of the Great Pyramid. That's how important this evidence is, and it's bunk.
All right. You put together this book. You've given a hard-edged look at this. Is mainstream science, historians, are they taking a serious look now at your research to maybe look at setting history right? Or are you being basically ignored by the mainstream on this?
Well, there's an old saying, Dave, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So you probably heard that expression before. Well, I'm at present, I would say I'm at the ignore stage and possibly maybe heading into the laughter stage with this. You know, people challenge the evidence. Not, I would say, mainstream Egyptologists yet, but they will, because they simply have to. You know, they have accepted these marks as genuine, basically on nothing more than the word of a British colonel who committed fraud earlier in his career. You know, this is not a guy who's in any way, shape or form credible, but yet these marks, this cartouche has been accepted as genuine on this guy's word, and that such is the, you know, the extent of you know, Victorian, you know, science. You know, that's about it. You know, it's just his guy's words. He's a British colonel. He wouldn't commit fraud. Well, yeah, he did, and he could, and he probably has done again. So Egyptology will struggle with the evidence that's presented in this book because, you know, I found this guy's private journal. I managed to track this guy's private journal because his published book, Dave, is written as a diary from his time in Egypt in 1837. His public, you know, his published book is written as a diary. So that means that obviously there was an original handwritten diary somewhere, which I managed to find. And, you know, I was looking at for this diary for actually another reason. But when I found it and I started reading it, my goodness, a whole load of other things just jumped out of the contradiction after contradiction between what's in his private thoughts and what is in his actual published account. It's just, you know, it's just a no-brainer. These marks are fakes. And we're now in a position where I personally feel that how anyone could actually believe these marks are genuine is just baffling. Yeah, there's guys that will say, because part of the hoax theory, the fraud theory, suggests that Howard Weiss had found some painted marks elsewhere and he'd copied them into these chambers, okay? It's explained in detail in the book. Now, people say, but you haven't found, you know, these painted marks elsewhere. So where did they copy them from? You know, and because I have not been able to show people that, you know, well, he copied them from here. You know, it's this secret cache of texts that I, you know, speculate that he copied into these chambers. Because I have not been able to present that specific evidence in the book, they claim, well, you know, they just dismiss the book because I can't present the original source. But hey, come on. You know, is Weiss going to leave the original source intact? You know, for, you know, somebody later to say that, well, look, you know, those marks are the exact same as the marks in those chambers that Weiss opened. That's strange. Also, you know, it's about like, Dave, you know, if you find a person on the ground and they're covered in blood, and there's a couple of shell casings and there's bullet holes in the window and there's blood everywhere. You know, that's like saying, well, the person wasn't shot, because you need to find the gun first. You know, that's right. Basically what these critics are saying. They're saying to me, well, you need to find the gun. But no, there's all this other evidence that points to the fact that it was a fraud. You know, they're dismissing all the other evidence simply because I can't find the gun. You know, that's what the critics, that's what the attacks basically on the evidence I presented in this book amount to. Well, you haven't found the gun, so this is all meaningless. I'm just going to ignore all this other evidence that you've presented, that, you know, the shell casings, you know, the bullet holes in the window. They're just going to ignore it all, you know?
Right. And that's the silly part, right? Because when you're able to show and discredit an aspect of this person's personality and prove that there is an ongoing set of deception that this man has used in many different aspects of his life, and you start to look at some of the stories that he's perpetrating regarding this, it's not a far stretch, and you should begin to question the authenticity of any claims that he makes going forward.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely, Dave. You know, but this isn't the only claims that have been leveled of cheating by Howard Weiss. He actually writes in his own book, well, during his researches at Giza, he writes in his published account that he was accused of, you know, trying to make money out of his discoveries at Egypt. You know, people were accusing him of all sorts of things. But I think that was probably written in his book because the person that was making these allegations against him threatened to put these matters in the British press. And they did, in fact, put these matters in the British press. So Weiss had to address those particular accusations of, you know, dodgy dealing while he was at Giza. You know, so this isn't a guy that's in any way credible. I just would not trust this guy with this particular discovery.
Definitely worth looking into. And for those of you just as fascinated by Egypt and the Great Pyramids, pick up the book, The Great Pyramid Hoax, The Conspiracy to Conceal the True History of Ancient Egypt. And remember, anything you purchase from the world's largest shopping mall, Amazon.com, you can now go a long way to help out your buddies here on Beyond the Darkness. If you go to podcastone.com, then click on the killer deals section. You'll find a link there for Beyond the Darkness. Click on that. You'll see links to Amazon.com. Every book, DVD, piece of furniture, clothing, anything that you purchase off of there, using that link, a small portion of the sale goes a long way to help out your buddies here and keep the show free, fun, and available to you. So you'll always be a part of the best in paranormal talk radio. Tomorrow night, we have Dalen Spratt joining us from The Ghost Brothers. Their new season on TLC launches Friday. And then Friday, we have Mysterious Tales from People You'd Least Expect with a fascinating, brand new Theater of the Mind. And I also want to mention tonight, I know a lot of our listeners are fascinated by alternative medicines. And tonight on Coast to Coast AM, George Norrie is hosting Dr. Joel Wallach and Open Lines. So during the first half, Dr. Joel Wallach will share alternative health approaches and the benefits of natural remedies and supplements that aid in the body's recovery from many diseases and ailments without the use of dangerous and expensive pharmaceuticals. And then it'll be followed by midweek Open Lines in the second half. That's on our show, Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie. And remember, I'll be back hosting Coast to Coast AM on Saturday, March 25th. So go check out the website, coasttocoastam.com, and always keep in the know for what's going on. You can find stations there. You can find ways to listen to the show, or you can subscribe and become a Coast Insider along the way. Well, that's it for this evening. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. You've been listening to the best in paranormal talk radio. Special thanks to our guest all the way in Glasgow, Scotland, Scott Crichton, The Great Pyramid Hoax, The Conspiracy to Conceal the True History of Ancient Egypt. You've been listening to Beyond the Darkness.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.